Welcome to Poetry Lectures, a series of lectures by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, we hear one of the major voices of American modernist poetry.
This is just to say I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox, and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold.
Like Chekhov, William Carlos Williams pursued a dual career as a doctor and writer. Williams was born in 1883 in Rutherford, New Jersey, the same town where he would spend most of his life. His father introduced him to Shakespeare, and his mother was a painter, but the young Williams was more interested in math and science, and enrolled at the University of Pennsylvania to study medicine. There he discovered the writings of Walt Whitman and met another student, Ezra Pound. After becoming a doctor, Williams married, moved back to Rutherford, and began his 41-year career as a physician. His first poems were published in 1909, and soon after he was included in several anthologies of the new Imagist poetry. Williams often spent his weekends in New York, where he became friends with writers and artists such as Mina Loy, Wallace Stevens, Man Ray, and Marcel Duchamp. During the 1920s, he made two trips to Europe, where he met James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, and others. Although early in his career he was published with the Imagist poets, Williams disagreed with many of their artistic values. As you'll hear in this talk, he was very opinionated, down-to-earth, and enjoyed a good joke. He especially disagreed with modernists Pound and T.S. Eliot and their use of classical references, and felt they relied too heavily on European traditions. Williams continually experimented in his writing as he tried to create a truly vernacular American poetry. He drew inspiration from the common American speech of his hometown, and even from his patients. When Williams gave this talk in 1951, he had just retired from his medical practice and was continuing to work on his epic poem, Patterson. He spent more time traveling, giving readings and lectures, and became an important mentor to younger poets, especially Kenneth Rexroth, Gary Snyder, and other beat poets emerging in the 1950s. He carried on a lengthy correspondence with Allen Ginsberg, and Ginsberg credits Williams for freeing his poetic voice. Williams died in 1963, 2 months before his last book, Pictures from Bruegel, would be awarded a Pulitzer Prize. Here is William Carlos Williams speaking at Harvard University in 1951.
All art is sensual. Listen. Never mind. Don't try to work it out. Listen to it. Let it come to you. Let it sit back, relax, and let the thing spray in your face. Get the feeling of it. Get the tactile sense of something, something going on. It may be that you will then perceive, have a sensation that you may later find will clarify itself as you go along. So that I say, don't attempt to understand the modern poem. Listen to it. And it should be heard. It's very difficult sometimes to get it off the page. But once you hear it, then you should be able to appraise it. In other words, if it ain't a pleasure, it ain't a poem. All art is made to please. That's the way it approaches you. Well, I'm going to try to read now poems written over a span of 30 or 40 years, so that there'll be all kinds of things. I'll read them without much explanation, but a little. This is a marriage ritual, 1928. Above the darkness of a river, upon winter's icy sky, dreams the silhouette of the city. This is my own, a flower, a fruit, an animal by itself. It does not recognize me and never will. Still, it is my own, and my heart goes out to it dumbly, but eloquently in my own breast for you whom I love. And can it express what my love is, how it varies, though I waste it? It is a river flowing through refuse, the dried sticks of weed, and falling shell ice, lilac from above, as if with thoughts of you. This is my face, and its moods my moods, a riffled whiteness, shaken by the flow that's constant in its swiftness as a pool. A pollock in the stinging wind, her arms wrapped to her breast, comes shambling near. To look at what, downstream? It is an old world of flavor, the poor, the unthrifty, passionately biased by what errors of conviction. Now a boy is rolling a stout metal drum up from below the riverbank. The woman and the boy, two thievish figures, struggle with the object in this light. And still there is one leafless tree just at the water's edge, and my face constant to you. This is burning the Christmas greens. Their time passed, pulled down, cracked, and flung to the fire, go up in a roar. All recognition lost, burnt clean, clean in the flame, the green dispersed, a living red, flame red, red as blood wakes on the ash, and ebbs to a steady burning. The rekindled bed become a landscape of flame. At the winter's midnight, we went to the trees, the coarse holly, the balsam, and the hemlock for its green. At the thick of the dark, the moment of the cold's deepest plunge, we brought branches cut from the green trees to fill our need, and over doorways about paper Christmas bells covered with tin foil and fastened by red ribbons, we stuck the green prongs. In the windows hung woven wreaths, and about pictures the living green. On the mantel we built a green forest, and among those hemlock sprays put a herd of small white deer, as if they were walking there. All this, and it seemed gentle and good to us. Their time passed, relief. The room bare. We stuffed the dead grate with them upon the half-burnt-out log's smoldering eye, opening red and closing under them, and we stood there looking down. Green is a solace, a promise of peace, a fort against the cold, though we did not say so. A challenge above the snow's hard shell, green, we might have said, that where small birds hide and dodge and lift their plaintive rallying cries, blocks for them and knocks down the unseeing bullets of the storm. Green spruce boughs pulled down by a weight of snow transformed. Violence leaped and appeared, reeking and roared to life as the flame rose through and our eyes recoiled from it. In the jagged flames, green to red, instant and alive, green, those sure abutments, gone, lost to mind. And quick in the contracting tunnel of the gate appeared a world, black mountains, black and red, as yet uncolored, and ash white, an infant landscape of shimmering ash and flame, and we in that instant lost, breathless to be witnesses, as if we stood ourselves refreshed among the shining fauna of that fire. The visit. This was a visit paid to me by, you should never explain a poem, but it always helps nevertheless. You want to get it. But it, sometimes it's a good thing to have a little private note on the side, because after all, you only hear it once. And it's very difficult to get any work of art the first time if it has any profundity. So that to save time, I might say that this was a very charming lady that came to see me on a very pointed mission. I have committed many errors, but I warn, the interplay is not the tossed body. Though the mind is subtler than the sea, advancing at three speeds, the fast, the medium, and the slow, recapitulating at every ninth wave what was not at first directly stated, that is still only on the one level. There are the fish, and at the bottom, the ground. No matter whether at 5 feet or 5 miles, the ground ravining when bared by the tides, living barnacles, hungry on the rocks as the mind is, that hiss as often loudly when the sun bites them. And I acknowledge the mind is still, though rarely, more than its play. I can see also the dagger in the left hand when the right strikes. It does not alter the case. Let us resume. The naive may be like a sunny day, deceptive, and is not to be despised because it is so amusing to see the zigzag and slender gulls dip into the featureless surface. It is fish that they are after, fish, and get them. Still, I acknowledge that the sea is there, and I admire its profundity. Only what does it amount to? Love also may be deep, deepest thought, deeper than thought, and as sequential. Thought full of detail, let us say, as the courts are full of law, and the sea weeds, and as murmurous. That does not alter the case either. Yet, you are right, in the end, law often decides cases. Well, I prefer to go back to my cases at the hospital. So I am less an artist than a spade worker. Say I am less an artist than a spade worker, but one who has no aversion to taking his spade to the head of any who would derogate his performance in the craft. You were very kind to be at such pains with me, and thank you for the hue. I decided to read poems that I hadn't read here before. I have read them, but I have read a good many of the older ones, but I decided not to today. So I'm reading more or less poems that haven't been heard before. This is The Lion. Traffic, the lion, the sophisticate, facing the primitive alabaster, the new fallen snow, stains its chastity the new shade. Use defames. The attack disturbs our sleep. This is the color of the road, the color of the lion, sand color. To follow the lion of use or usage, even to church, the bells that chime above the fallen snow, all follow the same road apace. Winter, the churned snow, the lion flings the woman, taking her by the throat upon his gullied shoulders. Shaking the weight fast and unmolested, plunges with her among the trees, where the whiteness sparkles, to devour her there, transit to uses, where the traffic mounts, a chastity packed with lewdness, a rule dormant against the loosely fallen snow, the thick muscles working under the skin, the head like a tree stump, gnawing, chastity to employment, lying down bloodied to bed together for the last time. Strange how much time it takes. Well, this is one that is sometimes liked because it seems more regular than most. This is Spring and All. Or really, it's best known as The Road to the Contagious Hospital. Now, you notice what I said. There is no subject that the modern poem cannot approach. There is no selected material. It's what you do with the work of art. It's what you put on the canvas and how you put it on that makes the picture. It's how the words fit in. Poems are not made of thought, beautiful thoughts. It's made of words, pigments, put on. Here, there, made, actually. By the road to the contagious hospital, under the surge of the blue mottled clouds driven from the northeast, a cold wind. Beyond, the waste of broad, muddy fields, brown with dried weeds, standing and fallen. Patches of standing water, the scattering of tall trees. All along the road, the reddish, purplish, forked, upstanding, twiggy stuff of bushes and small trees with dead brown leaves under them, leafless vines. Lifeless in appearance, sluggish, dazed spring approaches. They enter the new world naked, cold, uncertain of all save that they enter. All about them the cold, familiar wind. now the grass, tomorrow the stiff curl of wild carrot leaf. One by one, objects are defined. It quickens, clarity, outline of leaf, but now the stark dignity of entrance. Still, the profound change has come upon them. Rooted, they grip down and begin to awaken. And this one, I think, has been used for teaching. Modern American poetry is like a man without a head. We've got the whole body of English literature right there. All it needs is a head, that's all. This is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. Let me read it again. This is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. I've been psychoanalyzed. I think someone, I won't mention his name, The Secret of Dr. Williams is in the last line, and so cold. Well, I have some ideas on that too, but we won't talk about them here. Yeah. This is on gay wallpaper. The green-blue ground is ruled with silver lines to say the sun is shining. And on this moral sea of grass or dreams lie flowers or baskets of desires. Heaven knows what they are, between cerulean shapes laid regularly round, mat roses and tridentate leaves of gold, threes, three roses and three stems, the basket floating, standing in the horns of blue, repeated to the ceiling, to the windows where the day blows in the scalloped curtains to the sound of rain. And this... Well, I usually read this because Max Eastman said it's the only poem I ever wrote. I acknowledge it's good, but not that good. Not that good. This is Flowers by the Sea. When over the flowery, sharp pasture's edge, unseen, the salt ocean lifts its form, chicory and daisies tied, released, seem hardly flowers alone, but color and the movement of the shape, perhaps, of restlessness, whereas the sea is circled and sways peacefully upon its plant-like stem. And this, to a poor old woman munching a plum on the street, a paper bag of them in her hand, they taste good to her. They taste good to her. They taste good to her. You can see it by the way she gives herself to the one half sucked out in her hand. Comforted, a solace of ripe plums seeming to fill the air, they taste good to her. And this is one which is usually asked for. It's about as well known as anything I've done, called The Yachts. And there, here again, a little explanation. It was at the time of the international yacht races. I think the last race was held during the Depression, when it was about that time when there was a good deal of misery. And that is why the poem came to be written. The yachts The yachts contend in a sea which the land partly encloses, shielding them from the too heavy blows of an ungoverned ocean, which, when it chooses, tortures the biggest hulls the best man knows to pit against its beatings, and sinks them pitilessly. Moth-like in mists, scintillant in the minute brilliance of cloudless days, with broad bellying sails, they glide to the wind, tossing green water from their sharp prows, while over them the crew crawls ant-like, solicitously grooming them, releasing, making fast as they turn, lean far over, and having caught the wind again, side by side, head for the mark. In a well-guarded arena of open water, surrounded by lesser and greater craft, which sycophant, lumbering and flittering follow them, they appear youthful, rare as the light of a happy eye, live with the grace of all that in the mind is fleckless, free, and naturally to be desired. Now the sea which holds them is moody, lapping their glossy sides as if feeling for some slightest flaw, but fails completely. Today no race. Then the wind comes again. The yachts move, jacking for a start. The signal is set, and they are off. Now the waves strike at them, but they are too well made. They slip through, though they take in canvas. Arms with hands grasping seek to clutch at the prows. Bodies thrown recklessly in the way are cut aside. It is a sea of faces about them, in agony, in despair, until a horror of the race dawns, staggering the mind. The whole sea become an entanglement of watery bodies, lost to the world, bearing what they cannot hold. Broken, beaten, desolate, reaching from the dead to be taken up, they cry out, failing, failing, their cries rising in waves still as the skillful yachts pass over. Now going back a bit. This is a poem written 30 years ago, and then we'll get to some of the more modern ones. This is the museum referred to here is the Metropolitan Museum of Art. As you go into the Egyptian section, you'll see a granite sarcophagus. Very beautiful. Perhaps some of you have seen it. It's a marvelous piece of Egyptian carving. This is history. A wind might blow a lotus petal over the pyramids, but not this wind. Summer is a dry leaf. Leaves stir this way then that on the baked asphalt. The wheels of motor cars rush over them. Gas smells mingled with leaf smells. Oh, Sunday, day of worship. The steps to the museum are high. Worshippers pass in and out. Nobody comes here today. I come here to mingle faience dug from the tomb, turquoise-colored necklaces, and wind belched from the stomach, deliberately delicate, deliberately veined basins of agate, cracked and discolored, and the stink of stale urine. Enter. Elbow in at the door. Men, women, simpering clay fetish faces, counting through the turnstile. Ah! This sarcophagus contained the body of Uresh Nai, priest to the goddess Mut, mother of all. Run your finger against this edge. Here went the chisel. And think of an arrogance endured 6,000 years without a flaw. But love is an oil to embalm the body. Love is a packet of spices, a strong-smelling liquid to be squirted into the thigh. No? Love rubbed on a bald head will make hair. And after? Love is a lice comber, and gnats on dung. The chisel is in your hand, The block is before you. Cut as I shall dictate. This is the coffin of Ureshnai, priest to the sky goddess, built to endure forever. Carve the inside with the image of my death in little lines of figures 3 fingers high. Put a lid on it, cut with mut bending over the earth for my headpiece. And in the year to be chosen, I shall rouse. The lid shall be lifted, and I will walk about the temple where they have rested me and eat the air of the place. Ah, these walls are high. This is in keeping. The priest has passed into his tomb. The stone has taken up his spirit. Granite over flesh, who will deny its advantages? Your death? Water spilled upon the ground. The water will mount again to rose leaves, but you would hold life still, even as a memory when it is over. Benevolence is rare. Climb about this sarcophagus. Read what it writ for you in these figures, hard as the granite that has held them with so soft a hand, the while your own flesh has been 50 times through the guts of oxen. Read. I, who am the one flesh, say to you, the rose tree will have its donor, even though he gives stingily. The gift of some endures 10 years, the gift of some 20, and the gift of some for the time a great house rots and is torn down. Some give for 1,000 years to men of one face, some for 1,000 to all men, and some few to all men, while granite holds an edge against the weather. Judge then of love. My flesh is turned to stone. I have endured my summer. The flurry of falling petals is ended. Lay the finger upon this granite. I was well desired and fully caressed by many lovers, but my flesh withered swiftly and my heart was never satisfied. Lay your hands upon the granite as a lover lays his hand upon the thigh and upon the round breasts of her who is beside him. For now I will not wither. Now I have thrown off secrecy. Now I have walked naked into the street. Now I have scattered my heavy beauty in the open market. Here I am with head high and a burning heart, eagerly awaiting your caresses, whoever it may be, for granite is not harder than my lover's open runs loose among you. I, arrogant against death, I who have endured, I warn against the years. But it is 5 o'clock. Come, life is good, enjoy it. A walk in the park while the day lasts. I will go with you, look. This northern scenery is not the Nile, but these benches, the yellow and purple dusk, the moon there, these tired people, the lights on the water. Are not these Jews and Ethiopians? The world is young, surely, young and colored like a girl that has come upon a lover. Will that do? Well, this is an antidote, somewhat. Virtue. Now, why whirlpools of orange and purple flame, feather twists of chrome on a green ground, funneling down upon the steaming phallus head of the mad sun himself, black and crimson. Now, why, it is the smile of her, the smell of her, the vulgar inviting mouth of her. It is, oh, nothing new, nothing that lasts in eternity, nothing worth putting out to interest, nothing but the fixing of an eye concretely upon emptiness. Come, here are a cross-eyed men, a boy with a patch, men walking in their shirts, men in hats, dark men, a pale man with little black mustaches and a dirty white coat, fat men with pudgy faces, thin faces, crooked faces, slit eyes, gray eyes, black eyes, old men with dirty beards, men in vests with gold watch chains. Come! And this smell. Oh, strong-ridged and deeply hollowed nose of mine, what will you not be smelling? What tactless asses we are, you and I, bony nose, always indiscriminate, always unashamed. And now it is the souring flowers of the bedraggled poplars, a festering pulp on the wet earth beneath them. With what deep thirst we quicken our desire to that rank odor of a passing springtime. Can you not be decent? Can you not reserve your ardors for something less unlovely? What girl will care for us, do you think, if we continue in these ways? Must you taste everything? Must you know everything? Must you have a part in everything? This is the first time I've ever read this, and it got lost. It was left out of the last. This is the first time it's been published, anyhow. So we'll see what it is. This is a struggle of wings. Now, this is one way you got to lean back because you won't get it. Now, let us spray it, perhaps. Round clouds occluding patches of the sky, rival steam bluntly towering, slow spinning billows which rivaled the resting snow, which rivals the sun, beaten out upon it, flashing to a struggle of wings, which fills the still air, still but cold, yet burning. It is the snow risen upon itself. It is winter pressed breast to breast with its own whiteness, transparent yet visible, together with their pigeons' heads whose stupid eyes deceive no one. They hold up between them something which wants to fall to the ground. And there's the river with thin ice upon it, fanning out half over the black water, the free middle water racing under its ripples that move crosswise on the stream. But the wings and bodies of the pigeon-like creatures keep fluttering, turning together, hiding that which is between them. It seems to rest not in their claws, but upon their breasts. It is a baby. Now it is very clear. They're keeping the child naked in the air, warm and safe between them. The eyes of the birds are fixed in a bestial ecstasy. They strive together, panting. It is an antithesis of logic, very theoretical. To his face, the baby claps the bearded face of Socrates. Ho, ho, he's dropped it. It was a mask. Now, indeed, the encounter throws aside all dissimulation. The false bird heads drop back. Arms spring from the wing edges. All the parts of two women become distinct, the anatomy familiar and complete to the smallest detail, and meaning plainly anti-poetical, and all there is one. To greet a letter carrier. Won't you bring me a good letter, one with lots of money, and I can make use of it. Attaboy, attaboy. Well, if you like that, here's another at the bar. Hi, open up a dozen. What you trying to do, charge your batteries? Make it two. Easy, girl, you'll blow a fuse if you keep that up. I think that poetry comes out of the language that is spoken on the street.
You're listening to William Carlos Williams, speaking at Harvard in 1951. Considering the age of this recording, it's not surprising that it's in less than pristine condition. After a brief gap in the recording, we rejoin as Williams reads a poem titled, These. The first line of the poem is missing. It begins, "These are the desolate, dark weeks."
When nature, in all its barrenness, equals the stupidity of man. The ear plunges into night, and the heart plunges lower than night, to an empty, windswept place, without sun, stars, or moon, but a peculiar light, as of thought, that spins a dark fire, whirling upon itself, until in the cold it kindles to make a man aware of nothing that he knows, not loneliness itself, not a ghost, but would be embraced, emptiness, despair. They whine and whistle. Among the flashes and booms of war, houses of whose rooms the cold is greater than can be thought, the people gone that we love, the beds lying empty, the couches damp, the chairs unused. Hide it away somewhere out of the mind, let it get roots and grow, unrelated to jealous ears and eyes, for itself. In this mind they come to dig all. Is this the counterfoil to sweetest music? The source of poetry that seeing the clock stopped says, the clock has stopped that ticked yesterday so well. And here's the sound of lake water splashing that is now stone. These are somewhat later. This is Perfection. Oh, lovely apple, beautifully and completely rotten. Hardly a contour marred, perhaps a little shriveled at the top, but that aside, perfect in every detail. Oh, lovely apple. What a deep and suffusing brown mantles that unspoiled surface. No one has moved you since I placed you there on the porch rail a month ago to ripen. No one, no one. Fertile. You are a typical American woman. You think men grow on trees. You want love, only love, rarest of male fruit. Break it open, and in the white of the crisp flesh, find the symmetrical brown seeds. Oh, dear, there was one. On the other hand, this woman. How shall I describe her, who is wealthy in the riches of her sex? No counterfeit, no mere metal to be sure, yet a treasury, a sort of lien upon all property we list and transfer. This woman has no need to play the market or to do anything more than watch the moon, for to her thoughts are not like those of the philosopher or scientist, or clever playwright. Her thoughts are to her like fruit to the tree, the apple, pear. She thinks and thinks well, but to different purpose than a man, and I discover therein novel territory. It is a world to make the world little worth traveling by ship or air. Moscow, Zanzibar, and the Aegean Islands, the Crimea she surpasses by that which by her very being she would infer, a new world, welcome as to a sailor, and habitable, so that I am willing to stay there. Designed for November. Let confusion be the design, and all my thoughts go swallowed by desire, recessed from promises in the November of your arms. Release from the rose, broken reeds, straw pale through which from easy branches that mock the blood, a few leaves fall. There the mind is cradled, stripped also, and returned to the ground, a trivial and momentary clatter. Sleep and be brought down, and so condone the world, eased of the jagged sky and all its petty imageries, flying birds, its fogs and windy phalanxes. I've mixed them up as much as I can to just to give the impression that you really, I don't say that I have succeeded, but that you can, by arranging the words, make a poem out of anything, provided you have conceived it, you have seen it in your life, because the purpose of the artist, whatever it is to take the life which he sees and raise it up to an elevated position where it has dignity. Just the same as a Navajo Indian puts a mark around a clay water pitcher and makes it distinguished. So the artist's purpose in life, what he's for, why he's been preserved for the ages as he has been, the imperishable thing, the one imperishable thing that the world never lets die is the work of art. Cities are wiped out. Civilizations are wiped out. Homer persists. England will disappear. Shakespeare will be there. It's that. The race cherishes that. Cherishes the work of the artist. He's the most important creature in his generation. It's to raise life to its distinction. And this is to raise our life, which began as colonists on the eastern shore of the United States, to give a distinction so that we, when the time may pass, Toynbee's 300 years, 300 times 300, would be remembered as a culture if we follow and bring it to distinction, marked by works of art. Now you can call this anything you please. This is a picture of a nude in a machine shop. Picture of a nude in a machine shop and foundry. That's art. A red ostrich plume in her hair, sweat and muddy water, coiled few strips around her, poised sitting between red parted curtains, the right leg stockinged up beside the point, at ease, light as a glove, light as her black gloves, modeled as a shoe, a woman's high-heeled shoe, the other leg stretched out, bare, toward the top and upward, as the smeared hide under the shirt and pants, stiff with grease and dirt, is bare, approaching the centrum disguised, the metal to be devalued, bare as a blowtorch flame, undisguised. The tree lay down on the garage roof and stretched. "You have your heaven," it said. "Go to it." Venus over the desert. "If I do not sin," she said, "you shall not walk in long rows down stone corridors. There is no reprieve where there is no falling off. I lie in your beds at night, all night. From me you wake and go about your tasks. My flesh clings to your bones. What use is holiness unless it affirm my perfections, my breasts, my thighs, which you part shaking, and my lips, the door to my pleasures? Sin, you call it? But there cannot be cold unless the heat has bred it. How can you know otherwise? Love, comfort me in the face of my defeats. Poor monks, you think you are gentle, but I tell you, you kill as sure as shot kills a bird flying." Just have time for a couple more. And then, the birth of Venus? Sure. The birth of Venus. I sort of ducked this. It's strange. Somebody else asked for that when I was reading 2 weeks ago, so I better start to read it. Today's small waves are rippling crystal clear upon the pebbles at Villefranche, whence from the wall at the parade grounds of the Chasseur Alpin, we stood and watched them. Or passing along the cliff on the ledge between the sea and the old fortress, heard the long swell stir without cost among the rock's teeth. But we are not there. As in the Crimea, the Black Sea is blue with waves under a smiling sky, or be it the Labrador North Shore, or wherever else in the world you will, the world of indolence in April. As November next, spring will enliven the African coast southward, and we not there, not there, not there. Why not believe that we shall be young again? Surely nothing could be more to our desire, more pebble plain under a hand's breadth wavelet, a jeweled thing, a sapphic bracelet than this. Murder staining the small waves crimson is not more moving, though we strain in our minds to make it so and stare. Cordite, heavy shells falling on the fortifications of Sebastopol. Fired by the Germans first, then by the Russians, are indifferent to our agony, as are small waves in the sunlight. But we need not elect what we do not desire. Torment in the daisied fields before Troy, or at Amiens, or on the Manchurian plain is not of itself the dearest desire of the world. We do not have to die in bitterness and the most excruciating torture to feel. We can lean on the wall and experience an ecstasy of pain, if pain it must be, but a pain of love, of dismemberment, if you will, but a pain of almond blossom, an agony of mimosa trees in bloom, a scented cloud. Even as old Ford would say, an exquisite sense of viands. Would there be no sculpture, no painting, no Pinturicchio, no Botticelli, or frescoes on the jungle temples of Burma that the jungles have reclaimed, or Picasso at Cannes but for war? Would there be no voyages starting from the dunes at Huelva over the windy harbor? No Seville Cathedral? Possibly so. Even the quietness of flowers is perhaps deceptive. But why must we suffer ourselves to be so torn to sense our world, or believe we must so suffer to be born again? Let the homosexuals seduce whom they will under what bushes along the coast of the Middle Sea, rather than have us insist on murder. Governments are defeats, distortions. I wish, and so I fail, notwithstanding, I wish we might learn of an April of small waves, deadly as all slaughter, that we shall die soon enough to dream of April, not knowing why we have been struck down, heedless of what greater violence. And perhaps a good place to stop.
That was William Carlos Williams speaking at Harvard University in June 1951. Permission to use this recording was granted by New Directions Publishing Corporation and the Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard University. In a career spanning more than 50 years, William Carlos Williams published dozens of books of poetry, as well as plays, novels, and essays. His works are widely available in many collections and anthologies. You can read an extensive essay about William Carlos Williams and some of his poems at poetryfoundation.org. You'll also find articles about other poets and poetry, an online archive of more than 9,000 poems, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.